Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Last night, in Paris, France, in the middle of the night, Yasser Arafat, the leader of the Palestinians, died in the most unlikely way imaginable. He died of natural causes. The hero of Palestine, the symbol of Palestinian nationalism, no one ever expected would die of natural causes. He was a man who lived by the sword and one would expect would have died by the sword. As much he is a hero to the Palestinians and someone who received the Nobel Prize for Peace after the Oslo Accords in 1994, Yasser Arafat is also well known, at least prior to Osama bin Laden, as the world's greatest terrorist. Indeed, many of the ways terrorists fight today can largely be attributed to the actions of Yasser Arafat. Whether it's hijacking airplanes or in Munich taking over the Israeli athletes and shooting them, Yasser Arafat was known as someone who was trying out the latest in terrorist methods. He was someone who would go into schools, or at least send his men into schools, round up all the children, make them hostages, and then gun them down one by one. In fact, largely the suicide bombings that we've seen in the Palestinian territories are largely the idea of Yasser Arafat. It's true, people have done suicide bombings in the past, but on such a massive scale and involving women and children, I don't know of any other example in modern times except those that have followed in the path of Yasser Arafat. Yet he was a hero to his people, and indeed he was a man who very much put the idea of Palestinian nationalism on the map. Prior to Yasser Arafat, when people talked about Palestinians, they didn't mean Arabs, they meant Jews. In fact, the Jerusalem Post used to be called the Palestine Post. There were groups called the United Palestine Fund and the Palestine Agency set up by Jewish groups to help Jews escape to a place where they would be free from the persecution of the Holocaust. And prior to the 1960s, Palestinians were generally considered the Jews, who were there as a minority in a sea of Arabs. Well, Yasser Arafat, perhaps more than any other single person, changed all that. Today, when you say Palestinian, you mean Arab, and you generally refer to those who were refugees after Israel became a state in 1948. In 1948, some 600,000 Arabs left what became the state of Israel. Some 800,000 Jews were kicked out of Arab countries at the same time. The Jews were brought into Israel and made part of the country. The Arabs were placed in refugee camps in the portions of Palestine that were taken over by Egypt and Jordan. Egypt took over the Gaza Strip. The army of Jordan took over what became known as the West Bank, and they ruled those lands from 1948 till 1967. Put the Palestinians in refugee camps, never allowed them to become citizens. And it is out of that festering sore, if you will, that the Palestinian Liberation Organization was formed. Yasser Arafat was born in Cairo, Egypt, in 1929. He often claimed he was born in Jerusalem, but documents being what they are, his birth certificate shows he was born in Cairo. Arafat went and fought with the Egyptian army when the Egyptian army invaded the new state of Israel in 1948 and 49, and when they conquered the Gaza Strip. Then Arafat stuck around and helped form guerrilla actions against the new state of Israel back when the state of Israel did not include the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And in 1964, Arab countries formed the Palestinian Liberation Organization as a way to use the festering sore, if you will, of the Palestinians in refugee camps in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank as a way to attack Israel. And after the 1967 war, the Six-Day War, when Israel conquered the West Bank and the Gaza Strip following attacks by Egypt and Jordan, then the refugees became Israel's responsibility, and Yasser Arafat was forced to act in Jordan. He moved across the Jordan River and attacked Israel from Jordan and caused so many reprisals from Israel into Jordan, including full battles, and finally the government of Jordan had to have a war against the Palestinians themselves. They fought Arafat in September 1970 and kicked him out and forced him into Lebanon, where Arafat became part of the Lebanese Civil War and getting involved there and actually creating and owning a mini-state in Lebanon. Then, after that mini-state in Lebanon attacked Israel many times and Israel fought back, Arafat was exiled in Tunis, in Tunisia, for many years. Not even being there, in fact, when the Palestinian people began what was known as the First Intifada, or uprising, when children with stones, mostly, came and attacked Israelis, mostly after, interestingly enough, a car accident in Gaza, where an Israeli truck accidentally killed four Palestinian children. That largely began the Intifada, and the Intifada had an amount of success. Indeed, it had enough success that eventually Yasser Arafat was allowed by Israel as part of the Oslo Accords to come back in and take over the Palestinian lands. And he ruled, and for a time in the 90s, we thought there was a chance for peace. Barak, the Israeli Prime Minister, worked very hard with Bill Clinton, and at one time they offered Yasser Arafat more than 95% of the West Bank and Gaza, including even sections of the holiest city in Judaism, Jerusalem. Arafat refused the offer, and many learned that Arafat, while being an exceptional revolutionary, did not have much of a feel for actually ruling over people. Indeed, he became known for his cronyism, for taking millions, indeed hundreds of millions of dollars from the United States, the international community, and instead of using it for his people, the Palestinians, putting it into various bank accounts. Still, Arafat was a symbol, and the Palestinians had a lot of respect for him. Although after 2000, when the second Intifada occurred, it wasn't the same as the first. Children didn't use stones anymore. Instead, they strapped on suicide bombs and really went out to kill massive numbers of Israelis. And for a while, they succeeded until Israel started building a security fence, very much keeping down the terrorist attacks. Arafat was confined to the rubble of Ramallah in the West Bank for 2.5 years for beginning the second Intifada, the much more violent one. And, of course, he just died without ever realizing his goal of a Palestinian state. What's interesting is that the United States and Israel, in many ways to isolate Arafat, a person who believed that terrorism was the way to achieve his state, helped set up a separate system within the Palestinian Authority, a system where there would be a prime minister. But Arafat never gave enough power to his prime ministers. He always maintained the forces of power on his own. And now that he's dead, it will be very interesting to see what happens. It seems like, frankly, it's the best opportunity the Palestinians have had in a very long time to have a state of their own. I'm going to have two guests on the air with radically different opinions from themselves and from my own. My first guest is going to be Nadia Hijab. She is the executive director of the Palestine Center here in Washington, D.C. And then later on in the hour, I'm going to get a call from the Gaza Strip, from a Jewish settler, an Israeli settler in the Gaza Strip. His name is Ehud Zinar. He's with the Council of Netzarim. He's the assistant chairman of that body, and I'm sure he has very different views. Prime Minister Sharon of Israel wants to evacuate the Gaza Strip as part of a plan to begin a Palestinian state, to begin having trust measures between Israel and the Palestinians, and I'm certain that Ehud Zinar is very much against that plan. Anyway, you will have your chance to call in, to talk with both of them, to hear these varying different views. And I realize that all this history is quite confusing for someone not familiar with it. So if something is said, or I'm going too fast, or things aren't clear to you, please call in. Express your opinion. Ask questions. Write into the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. The call-in number is toll-free. 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. If you do call in, I'm going to ask you to keep your questions relatively short. We don't have a lot of time with these callers. Ms. Hijab is actually taking a lot of time out of her day, the day after Arafat's death. You can imagine how important that is at the Palestine Center, of which she's the executive director, to come in and talk. So please keep your questions short, but please call in toll-free 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with Nadia Hijab, and later on, Ehud Zinar, right after these messages.
I've been chastised by Walmart. The largest corporation in the world apparently was stung by one of my recent commentaries. I'd pointed out that Walmart, which touts itself as a model of free market success, actually has built its market muscle in large part by milking us taxpayers, having squeezed more than $1 billion in subsidies from state and local governments, giving it a competitive advantage to clobber local businesses. In response, Sarah Clark, Director of Corporate Communications at Wally World, fired off a missive to media outlets that carried my Walmart commentary. She asserted that it was, quote, full of inaccuracies. Was the key figure of $1 billion in taxpayer giveaways to Walmart inaccurate? No, she did not dispute it. Rather, Walmart's chief PR flack tried to change the subject, offering numbers purporting to show that the company is a generous corporate citizen. In the past 10 years, Miss Clark informs us, Walmart has paid $4 billion in property taxes alone. But wait, it owed those taxes. This was not a contribution, but a debt. Other businesses pay property taxes, too, yet they don't get $1 billion in special subsidies. Then Miss Clark notes that her company, quote, generated $52 billion in sales taxes. But wait again, that's not Walmart's money. It's money that local consumers paid to finance public services. This money is also the result of sales that the monopolistic giant took from local businesses. Walmart doesn't expand a community's buying power. It just redistributes purchases from other stores to itself. But Ms. Clark presses on, claiming that Walmart has remitted $192 million in wage taxes. Once more, however, this money is not a voluntary contribution from a good-hearted company. It's taken out of the employees' wages, as required by law. This is Jim Hightower saying, to see the full report about how Walmart does indeed milk taxpayers, go to goodjobsfirst.org.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
The holiday taste of Sam's Club is here. Save time and money by shopping for all of your holiday business and home entertaining needs in one convenient stop. Visit the club this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, to sample a variety of delicious food perfect for any occasion. While you're there, you can pick up gifts for your employees, family, and friends. During this busy holiday season, don't miss your chance to shop, sample, and save on all of your business and home entertaining needs at the Holiday Taste of Sam's Club this weekend. Sam's Club, we're in business for small business.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine. We are talking about the death of Yasser Arafat, who died sometime in the middle of the night last night. And my first guest is Nadia Hijab. She's executive director of the Palestine Center in Washington. Ms. Hijab, welcome to the Inside Scoop. Ms. Hijab, let's try again. Ms. Hijab, are you there?
I'm here, yes. Can you
okay.
hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine.
Okay.
Okay. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I was talking to my listeners about what the death of Arafat means to the Palestinians and what the prospects are for peace over the next few years. Let me ask you, and first of all, let me extend my condolences to you. I know how much Yasser Arafat means to a large number of the Palestinian people.
Thank you.
What was Yasser Arafat, both as a symbol to the Palestinians and as a real-life human being?
As a symbol, he symbolized the Palestine question, that he unified a people that was dispersed, exiled, found itself in refugee camps and under Israeli occupation, and helped them to speak with a unified voice to the world state, to the world and make its case. So he did symbolize Palestine.
But as an actual human being, I think many Palestinians
being,
would
yes.
say he had some flaws, particularly with regard to corruption and things like that.
As an actual human being, I think the main he had two or three main failings. One is he did not have a vision for – he was not able to articulate a vision of where the cause was going and line up the necessary power to achieve that. Secondly, when it came to make – the transition from being a leader to being a governor of the Palestinians' affairs, I think he was still using a lot of the tactics he was using when he was in exile. You know, when you're on the road and all the bank accounts are in different places and all that kind of thing. And the Palestinians actually made a very strong call for reform, and about 2-3 years ago, there were reforms. Nobody has ever accused him personally of being corrupt, but of allowing corruption to flourish around him. And as a result of Palestinian pressure, a finance minister was appointed who brought the public treasury under control.
Let me ask you, if I could, about the 2000 Camp David Accords. President Clinton has written that he really felt that Yasser Arafat missed his chance in 2000 at the Camp David Accords and later at Taba to accept an Israeli offer of more than 95% of the disputed lands, including even parts of Jerusalem, and to not even provide a counteroffer. And at least President Clinton's view was that Yasser Arafat really missed a chance to create an independent state of Palestine at that time. My question for you is, do you agree with Clinton's assessment, and do you think a number of Palestinians agree with that assessment?
I do not. I do not believe that Arafat could have signed off at Camp David and still remained a leader of the Palestinians. What's come out since is that there wasn't even a map being used to underpin the discussions and the talks at Camp David. It's also important to note that there was a big difference between Camp David and Taba. At Camp David, what the Israelis appear to be saying is that the West Bank and Gaza that would be left to the Palestinians, the West Bank would be truncated into three parts. Israel would retain control of large chunks of land for its settlements, and the Palestinians wouldn't have sovereign control over their resources. And then the sovereignty over East Jerusalem was not, on offer, and neither was a solution for the refugees. At Taba, the two sides got much, much closer, and you could have had peace in the Middle East at Taba, except that within the next month, Ariel Sharon was elected as prime minister and immediately began to demonize Arafat and invade and attack Palestinian areas.
I should note there is a lot of controversy over this. I myself have seen the maps put out by the Orient House, which is the Palestinian, I don't know if you call it embassy, but the main Palestinian headquarters, I would say, in Jerusalem, that did show maps that were contiguous, that were offered at Camp David. But I guess my question is, apart from what happened, I think Clinton most criticized Arafat for not at least proposing a counteroffer. If he didn't like the offer that the Israelis put on the table, why not put forward a counteroffer and negotiate? And Clinton's view that Arafat really was not ready to transform himself from a revolutionary leader to being the leader of a state?
Well, I think that's not borne out by the fact that in Taba they did reach a much further agreement. And it's also, you have to remember that Camp David came about 7 years after the negotiations began. And by by the year 2000, Arafat found himself finally was faced to realize that he was negotiating about the occupation rather than finding himself the leader of an independent state and an end to occupation as had been envisaged back in 93. Between 93 and 99, the number of settlers in the West Bank and Gaza actually doubled from 200,000 to 400,000. And so that's the kind of situation he was faced with. He has wanted to make peace with the Israelis for 20 years, and he's gone further than I think any other Palestinian could have gone and still remained a leader, because he brought, I think it's his leadership that convinced the Palestinians by 1988 that they could not liberate all of Palestine as they wished, and that a more realistic goal was to have a state alongside Israel. And that was a big achievement, but then the state continued to be a dream because the settlements were never taken out.
Do you think the Palestinians, and I know it's very hard to speak for a mass of people who I'm sure have as many different views as we Americans have of our own, but do you think that the middle Palestinians, if you will, the majority, have reconciled themselves that their independent state will not encompass what was mandatory Palestine before 1948, that indeed they will live alongside a Jewish state side by side?
I believe the majority have reconciled themselves to that, yes. He managed to deliver that majority, and that's something I think in the future that will be recognized. At present, it serves Sharon's policy, I believe, to demonize him and characterize him as not being a partner for peace. But I think when historians look back at the fact that he did manage to bring the Palestinian people behind him to that realization, it was very hard, and it took over 20 years, that was a realistic goal that could have been achieved and could have saved many, many lives on both sides.
Of course, for all that Arafat has been reviled, and indeed he did create many methods that I think maybe even you would consider to be pretty harsh things, killing civilians, attacking children, things like that. Arafat is gone now, and Sharon certainly can't blame all the problems on Arafat anymore. He's gone. Do you think in the future that there is a real opportunity now for new Palestinian leadership to negotiate with the Israelis and come to a settlement?
Well, not if the Israelis don't abide by the land for peace formula, which is at the basis of all the peace agreements, which is withdrawal to the 67 borders and a Palestinian state. I don't think any leadership can afford to be more moderate than that and still lead the Palestinians. And what's really interesting is, and by the way, I am totally opposed to any attack on civilians, whoever the attacker is and whatever methods they use. That's just simply forbidden under international law.
I'm glad to hear that. I am as well.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what I was going to say, is that if you look at the polls, Palestinian support for terrorist attacks is at an all-time low when there is a peace process. When there isn't a peace process, when they see themselves and their families and their children coming under attack and their homes demolished, then the support for these attacks rises. And I think what would be very, very helpful to the peace process at this stage would be if the United States could mediate a ceasefire on both sides and maybe even support an international protection force that would go in between the two sides, manage that ceasefire, you know, and then facilitate the Israeli withdrawal.
Do you think that the wall helps indeed separate the forces and indeed might be the basis for a ceasefire, at least until there is a final negotiation?
No, what the wall has done is carve its way through some of the Palestinians' best land, destroying olive trees that are hundreds of years old and orchards and really taking over the land and penning the Palestinians into tiny little enclaves from which they can't go back and forth. It's been the whole case of the wall has been reviewed by the highest court in the world, the International Court of Justice, and it has confirmed that it is illegal, and it said not only is it illegal, but Israel has to make reparation for the Palestinians for the damage that they've suffered as a result of the wall. And the International Court of Justice, which has judges from all over the world, and was pretty unanimous about this, said that, you know, international law has to apply to this conflict. And that's a very, very clear statement, which hopefully will be used in future negotiations.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is you support international force as a ceasefire to separate the peoples. The wall separates the peoples without putting troops in the middle in harm's way. And it would seem as an interim solution, not as a final way to solve the problem, but as an interim solution, that might be a useful thing.
Well, the wall has taken hundreds of hectares, of thousands of hectares of Palestinian land, taken it away from its farmers, and it cuts through whole neighborhoods, prevents people from seeing each other. That would not be the case with an international protection force. And then the wall clearly, because it's well into Palestinian land, it is not on the border between on the 67 border, which everybody sees as a future border between Israel and Palestine. It's well into Palestinian land, and so, as I say, the International Court found that there was no justification to have it there. So, many people have said if Israel wants security through a wall, it can certainly build such a monstrosity on its side of the border. It doesn't have to build it inside Palestinian land.
One of the things I guess I haven't understood in the Palestinian cause, and I know that Abba Iban, who was a left liberal labor leader of Israel, once said the Palestinians have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. One thing I've never understood is why don't the Palestinians take land that's offered them and then negotiate for more? For example, Ariel Sharon, I know, has a plan to unilaterally withdraw from the Gaza Strip. I know you're no fan of Prime Minister Sharon, but why not take that and accept that and make that a Palestinian state and at the same time work to achieve more in the West Bank?
Well, because it's what he is going to do through his unilateral withdrawal is simply move his troops and besiege Gaza, and any Palestinians who are going to, it's going to be like a huge prison camp, which it is now, except with the troops inside. The troops would be outside, and the Palestinians wouldn't have any control over airspace, or, you know, the borders, or the sea.
Guess my question is, wouldn't they be better off than they are now if they indeed had, say, Gaza and large portions of the West Bank? At least they'd be better off. It would be a start of a state, and you might not get everything you want, you know, down to the last boundary of 1967, which divided Jerusalem, but at least the Palestinians would be able to rule themselves and not be subject to Israeli checkpoints and all the things that Palestinians are very upset about.
Well, what the Sharon plan is, just to be very clear, is to withdraw from just four settlements in the West Bank.
And all of Gaza.
A tiny little portion, and all of Gaza. Gaza is 1% of historic Palestine, you know. And he wants to continue to besiege it and maintain control over all the border. You cannot have a free, sovereign, independent people. But then you have to look at it also from the other perspective. The Palestinians are a people, constitute a people, and have national rights. And they are not in a position to sit down and wait for Israel to give them whatever it likes. I mean, they're going to continue, and they have been for decades, you know, to work until their full rights get realized. So if you want to have peace in the Middle East, I mean, they are suffering far more than the Israelis, but the Israelis are suffering too, and the whole region is always on the brink of a flare-up. There's a potential for nuclear outbreak there because Israel has a lot of nuclear weapons, and other states in the region could eventually get those. So it's a scary part of the world. And until you have the basic rights of people achieved in a way that the majority on both sides can live with, then you're not going to have a solution to the conflict.
Mr. Jab, what do you see as the future of the Palestinian Authority after Yasser Arafat? Who do you think is likely to take control, and what kind of person, do you think this will be someone who forswears violence or someone who will negotiate with the Israelis?
Well, I think in the short term, we've seen the lineup. It's very clear. The Palestinian, the prime minister, remains prime minister, Ahmed Guraya, and Arafat's deputy at the PLO becomes leader of the PLO. That's Mahmoud Abbas. They have both been termed, quote-unquote, moderates, but I don't think, as I said, I don't think that anyone can sign off an agreement that does not provide for basic Palestinian rights. Now, this is leadership in the short term. If these leaders cannot lead the Palestinians to freedom, I think you might see different and new leaders emerging that are not on the horizon today. You might also see for a while some turmoil internally, but I think one of Arafat's legacies is a maturity and an understanding of the importance of national unity that the Palestinians have grown up with in the last 50 years of their struggle.
Do you think Mr. Abbas and Mr. Guraya have wide popular support among the Palestinians?
Of the Palestinian leadership, Arafat was the one that had high support because of his respect. The others don't have as much support, no.
Okay, let me go quickly to a caller, and then I know you have a lot of things to do today. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. Please ask a brief question. Caller, you there? I'm not sure why I can't hear the caller. Caller, are you there? Well, I'm afraid we've lost the caller. Let me thank you, Ms. Hijab, for coming here on the Inside Scoop. As I said, I know you have a very busy day ahead of you, and I want to thank you very much for taking the time to be on the show. Well, you heard it. That was Ms. Nadia Hijab, the executive director of the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., giving her perspective on the death of Yasser Arafat. When we come back, we will be getting a phone call from the Gaza Strip, indeed from an Israeli settler in the Gaza Strip, in Netzarim, who not only wouldn't support the Camp David Accords, but doesn't support Sharon's plan to leave the Gaza Strip. You'll hear a very different perspective. If you want to call in, I encourage you to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. And again, I don't know what happened with the phones before. If you called in and tried to reach me, please call back. Also, you can give an entry to the blog. Just go to www.radioinsidescoop.com and comment as you will on the weblog. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
The U.S. Air Force is in rapture over its new baby, which it has named Raptor. We taxpayers, however, can be forgiven if we're less than enraptured by the recent birth of this F-A-22 fighter jet. For it's the most expensive warplane in history, it's not needed, and there are serious doubts about whether it'll even work. The Raptor was conceived 23 years ago in the heat of the Cold War. It was intended to replace the trusty F-15 fighter and was designed to battle a new jet the Soviets were developing. But the Soviet jet never got off the ground, the Soviet Union itself collapsed, the Cold War is long gone, and the enemies we battle today are far different, requiring entirely different weaponry. Indeed, no one threatening the U.S. today has an air force that can even battle the old reliable F-15s. Despite the changed world, however, Lockheed Martin, the maker of Raptor, just kept pushing ahead, using its campaign contributions and lobbying clout to keep Congress feeding our tax dollars into this voracious boondoggle. Lockheed brags that the FA-22 is the most technologically advanced plane ever built, but what it does best is eat money. Each Raptor costs us $258 million, and the Air Force is buying 277 of them. That's nearly four times the price tag originally submitted by Lockheed. Is the company accountable for such a gross cost overrun? No, no, Nanette. Lockheed got a sweetheart deal called a cost-plus contract, which bills all overruns to you and me, not to the corporation. What do we get for our billions? A flawed product. In March, Congress's budget office reported that the Raptor, quote, was not meeting its requirements for a reliable aircraft. Nonetheless, the Air Force is now deploying them. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, the day before Lockheed delivered its first Raptor, it announced a 41% jump in its profits.
The following is brought to you by Pfizer and Viagra Sildenafil Citrate.
So this morning, I'm looking into my shaving mirror, my wife's still in bed, and this guy is staring back at me with a mischievous glint in his eye. He looks familiar. So I say, Wild Thing? Is that you? You're back.
Not all medications are for everyone, so consult with your doctor first. Then ask if Viagra is right for you. To learn more, visit Viagra.com.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massage and gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's. Know who's really gelling? The King of Queens. Monday through Friday. Check your local listings.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're discussing the future of Middle East peace after the death of Yasser Arafat. And my first guest was Executive Director of the Palestine Center here in Washington, D.C. And it was very interesting to me how really the Palestinians are still adhering to their maximalist goals. I understand that anyone in negotiation wants to try to get the best they can. That's the way negotiations work. But did you notice how she always said that the Palestinian leaders have got to adhere to the 1967 borders? They won't take just Gaza. They won't take just even at Camp David, which was offered Gaza, and more than 95% of the West Bank. They really want it all. Now, it is true that she was willing to accept that the State of Israel can exist. One could consider that a compromise. But it seems to me that if you want 100% and you're offered 95%, that maybe you just ought to take it. Maybe that indeed was Arafat's mistake. And as many of you have pointed out, Arafat was indeed someone who – he was someone who took – she didn't say how much, but billions of dollars, as it turns out, from America, from Europeans, and put it in his pocket and didn't use it to help the poor, which is something that many of you have pointed out on the blog. My next guest is Israel. His name is Ehud Zinar. He's in the settlement of Netzarim. Now, Netzarim is an Israeli settlement in Gaza. It's one of those settlements that Prime Minister Sharon of Israel wants to evacuate. You heard from the Palestinian, encourage you to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Ehud Zinar, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
How you doing, Mark?
I'm good. Thank you for calling all the way from Israel. We really appreciate that.
Yes, it's great being on your show. It's been very interesting.
Thank you. Were you able to hear the first half?
Yes, most of it. I got, you know, up 20 minutes or the
okay,
half hour.
Well, you heard some of it.
You know, as our rabbi says, you know, it's not really the world, and the truth must be said, that Yasser Arafat is the worst terrorist since Hitler. He's a thief, he's a liar, was lying about his place of birth. He had taken lots of money for himself instead of helping the poor. He didn't really care about the state for the Palestinians. He didn't really care about the people in Europe. They don't live with Palestinian Authority. So, the thing that we should really concentrate on is, what lesson did we learn from this infamous terrorist, Yasser Arafat?
And what lesson did you learn from the terrorist acts of Yasser Arafat?
We think that the world didn't learn a thing, and that's very scary, because the successors of Arafat are going to see that terror is you know, they're going to be rewarded. He was a terrorist. He was rewarded. He was invited to the White House several times, like every other week. And they're going to say, hey, you know, we should keep on being terrorists. It pays. He was called the head of state. I mean, if I were to be an American citizen, I would have called the White House. I would have sent a fax to my president and said, listen, you call him head of state. You invite him to the White House as an equal person, like an equal among you and him. And I don't think Mr. President is a terrorist. This guy is a liar, he's a terrorist, he's a killer, and you should not treat him as an equal.
Mr.
Zinar, this is something that we should all be alarmed with.
Let me concede and agree with everything you say. Yasser Arafat was a notorious terrorist. He was someone who very much taught the world and the techniques of terrorism. And he was an all-round bad guy. He killed children. He's someone I don't have a lot of sympathy for. But at the same time, do you believe that the Palestinian Arab people do have legitimate grievances and they should have a state on their own and that one Israel can negotiate with?
Let me ask you a question. I mean, really, really. The fact whether they should or not have a state of their own, it's really not to us. And we try to avoid politics. We are Netzarim. We try to do with the real things, everyday life of common people. And to tell the truth, many people who live in Gaza, Palestinians, and we, you know, our town is not really within Gaza. We're about a mile and a half south of Gaza City. But many of them used to work for us in our greenhouses. We taught them the technique. We taught them how to set up greenhouses and grow vegetables on sand, you know, just sand. You could not believe you can grow organic vegetables in such an environment. And when we spoke to them, many of them said, you know, that move of bringing over those people from Tunisia, Arafat and his people, was a major mistake, and they'd rather go back. They have 15 years and just keep on their lives the way they used to do before Arafat, because they had jobs, they could support their families. The Israeli government supported the hospitals in Gaza City, supported the schools in some ways, not in 100%, but they did. And those institutions, those community institutions, they never had them between 1948 and 1967 before we acquired the land.
But Mr. Zinar, let's go through the history. Certainly between 1948 and 1967, Egypt very badly mistreated the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, put them in camps, didn't allow them to become Egyptian citizens. And then under Israeli rule, they maybe have done better than under Egyptian rule, but certainly they didn't have a state of their own. I can agree with you that since the Second Intifada, things have gotten pretty miserable for the Palestinians in Gaza. There's huge joblessness and real problems. But can't they have something better? I mean, if under Sharon's plan, Israel will leave Gaza entirely. They'll actually evacuate your settlement of Netzarim. And at least in Gaza, the Palestinians will be able to rule themselves and have some small corner of earth that they can call home. What's wrong with that?
Okay. God forbid if that withdrawal plan will be executed. God forbid. I was in the States about 3 weeks ago, and I was just giving a lecture about our town and our belief ideology and what the risks are and everything. And a gentleman comes to me. He drew a map of the state of Israel. And, you know, they have been bombing our towns day in and day out, not only the towns within the Gaza Strip, also towns outside the Gaza Strip. And our army is there. Could you imagine what happened once we withdraw from that area? So he drew a map of the state of Israel. And according to his map, they could cover the entire state with light artillery, with bomb shells, with Qassam rockets. It's going to be very dangerous. Now, people tend to think, you know, I came to the U.S., and people tend to think, you know, it's only 5 miles, it's 5 miles away. It's not really, you know, but I'm telling the people, it's on your doorstep. And when terrorists see that terror is rewardable, they will keep on doing it. And you know, mind you, 9/11 was a terror attack. And if terrorists will see that, come on, they'll keep on doing that.
Mr. Zinner,
we have to retaliate.
I want to ask you about...
Go ahead. Our approach is that Prime Minister Sharon should be told by leaders of the world, you should not withdraw from that land. You should not show them that terror is, you know, they're being rewarded. You shouldn't do that. It's wrong.
I want to ask you about the history of Netzarim. I'm well aware that there were many Jewish areas in the West Bank that had to be evacuated after Jordan invaded, including large Jewish communities in Hebron, certainly in Jerusalem. But I'm unaware of any significant Jewish communities in the Gaza Strip in the days preceding Israel's founding until after Israel took over the Gaza Strip and put in the settlement of Netzarim in 1972. Am I wrong? I may well be wrong. What is the purpose of Netzarim?
Yes, that's amazing. All right. Jews came to Gaza. The first time Jews came to Gaza, it's in the Bible. It's like when Joshua brought them across the Jordan River, and the tribe of Judea actually received that piece of land. It was Gaza. It's mentioned in the Bible and the part of the land of Judea. Now, Jews lived there throughout history. Even after the Second Temple was destroyed, Jews remained in Gaza. Now,
were they there in the 1920s, the 1930s?
I'm sorry?
Were they there in the 1920s, the 1930s?
Yes. One second. The largest ancient synagogue ever found in Israel was found in Gaza City, right there. Now, Jews came back to Gaza in the new era back about 100 years ago. They were chased away. They were slaughtered during the 1936 riots. They were chased away, and they returned only back in 1947. They set up a village, and then after the 1948 war, they were chased away again. They came back after 1967, and we have been there since 1967. Netzarim itself was founded back in 1972. So what people say that Jews hadn't been there, it's not really a Jewish state, this is wrong. We have been there for years, for thousands of years, and there are, you know, archaeology, you can find it right there.
Well, I guess, Mr. Zeno, I have the same question I had for Ms. Hijab, and that is, I understand that you want it all. I understand that. I understand Ms. Hijab wants all of the West Bank and Gaza, I understand that you want to keep this land. It is valuable to you, and after all, it's where you and your family live. But if we're ever going to resolve this crisis with violence, and don't we have to have a homeland for the Palestinians? Don't we have to give them some area of land so that doesn't there have to be compromise on both sides here?
No, we think. I mean, actually, we know history shows us that if we don't set foot and tell terrorists, listen, we don't play by that. You know, the game has different rules. And as long as you don't play by the rules, you know, we dismiss you, we discard you, and you're not the person to talk with. And that's what the world should say to the Palestinian people and its leadership, okay? That's the first thing they must understand. Now, as long as they don't do that, there is no negotiation. They have been killing women and children, elderly people. They have been bombing. Actually, they have bombed our town about 2 days ago. Some bombshells fell there. It's unbelievable what's going on. And by giving them whatever state, or, I mean, the withdrawal plan of our prime minister is a very bad move. It will show them that they should keep on bombing us. Could you imagine, just imagine that following 9/11, there would be a federal law that there are going to be no more skyscrapers in the United States. I mean, on the contrary, once the World Trade Center fell down, they decided to build a taller building. And that's how you retaliate. You tell them, we will not be intimidated.
But, Mr. Zinar, let me ask you this.
We will keep on with our lives.
Let me ask you this.
That's very important.
Israel is a democratic country, and it has an elected legislature, the Knesset. And the majority of the Knesset, representing the majority of Israelis, supports Prime Minister Sharon's plan, believes that not that the Palestinians can be trusted completely, but that if Israel leaves Gaza, and that this would be a test, a way to see whether the terrorist attacks continue or not. If they do, then Israel can maintain the West Bank, but if they don't, then Israel can slowly leave land. That, after all, Gaza is an extremely small area. It's very crowded. The people, the Palestinian Arabs there, do not live very well. Why do you think the majority of Israelis disagree with you?
You see, that's very interesting, because our intelligence people and the commander-in-chief of the army disagree with the politicians. Now, you see, politicians tend to do two things. First, they follow the crowd. Second, they look forward to their next term. And we, our job, the people, and not only the people of Israel, everybody in the world, tell them, listen, be strong, do the right thing, we are behind you. We will help you fight terror. We will not be intimidated. And once everybody does that, they will understand that they can do what's right, and they can keep on fighting terror the right way. Now, it's not only us. Of course, we live there. We're only 2 miles away from Gaza City. It's dangerous. Right. But let me tell you something.
Okay, then we have to go to commercial. Real quick.
Many of our listeners are Christian. They used to come here every year, you know, to visit the holy places, and they don't do that anymore. They are intimidated by terror, not by us. And everybody's getting hurt. I mean, flying domestic flights in the U.S. used to be fun. It's not fun anymore. And if we give in to terror once, it will come back to our doorstep. And we must not give in to terror.
Mr. Zinar, I want you to hang on. We're going to go to a commercial break, and then we're going to go to some of the callers that are on the phones. If you want to call in and ask Mr. Zinar a question, he's calling all the way from the Gaza Strip. Here's your chance to ask him a tough question, or maybe you agree with him. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
The dumbest thing that a political party can do is to abandon its reason for existence and try to become a pale imitation of the other party. Yet this is exactly what some of the so-called political pros are prescribing for Democrats. The latest conventional wisdom from these insiders is that Bush's election is a triumph of moral values over such big issues as war and the economy. George W., they say, bluntly professes that he's guided by God, thus causing evangelical Christians to vote for him, even against their economic self-interest. Therefore, they assert, Democrats can't win until they get like George and start appealing to Christian fundamentalists. Nonsense. Certainly, the working people and poor folks who are in those churches must be appealed to by Democrats, but not like George, not on the narrow basis used by Republicans, God, guns, and gays. Rather, Democratic candidates must openly profess, by word and deed, the deeply held fundamental moral values that the party was created to represent. Fairness, justice, and opportunity for all. This is high moral ground, which the Bushites routinely desecrate with virtually all of their policies and actions. Yet it's ground that Democrats senselessly have abandoned. It's not that evangelical working-class Christians voted against their own economic self-interest on November 2nd, but that the Kerry campaign had failed to appeal to it with any clarity or credibility. The candidate himself was aloof, elitist, and surrounded by upscale professionals, and the campaign gave little sense that a Kerry administration would be an FDR-JFK-LBJ champion of America's underdogs. This is Jim Hightower saying, yes, Democrats must talk more directly about values, the core Democratic values that make the party important. These are not only the values that founded America, but in church terms, they're the values preached and practiced by Jesus.
I have these nightmares. This taco, not just an ordinary taco, but this big evil taco is haunting me.
Guacamole.
You see, I was exposed to credit cards in college, and I wasn't the most responsible person back then.
Go, go, go!
I mean, I heard the words credit card and thought, hey, free money! Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. 135 taco dinners? Bam! Credit card. But hey, it's not too late to do something about your credit. Get ScorePower from Equifax.com. ScorePower gives you your credit report, credit score, and it puts you on the road toward the credit you deserve for just $14.95. So, check out Equifax.com today and get that taco you ate 7 years ago out of your life.
Get ScorePower at Equifax.com or 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Adios, taco.
Get the power. ScorePower at Equifax.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about the possibility for Middle East peace after the death of Yasser Arafat. And I've had two guests this hour, and I disagree with both of them. My first guest was Nadia Hijab. She was executive director of Palestine Center in Washington. And she talked really about the maximalist demands of the Palestinians. They want all of the West Bank. They want all of Gaza. And they really can't accept a leadership that offers less than that. And now, my guest on the air right now is a settler in Netzarim, in the Gaza Strip, and he doesn't even support Prime Minister Sharon's plan to evacuate Gaza to give the Palestinians a small piece of earth. I have to say, I understand that Mr. Zinar does not want to give in to terrorism. I don't like to give in to terrorism either. But at the same time, I think there should be some small patch of earth the Palestinians should call a state. If you want to call in, all you have to do is call in toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. Mr. Zinar is here all the way from the Gaza Strip, all the way from the Netzarim settlement, and it's your chance to ask him your questions. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Ehud Zinar.
This is Ed from New York, and I have two quick questions.
Yes.
The first one is, he didn't answer your question as to how many people were there in the 20s and 30s.
Okay.
And I'd like to know the answer, how many non-Arab people were there then.
Okay.
And the second question is, what, if anything, would he give up in order to achieve peace with the Palestinians?
Great questions. Thank you, Ed. Mr. Zinar, two questions. How many Jews were there in the 1920s and 1930s, and what would you give up to achieve peace?
All right. First, I don't have the exact information as far how many people were there, but I would love to get back to Ed and just, you know, Ed, if, you know, you can contact me either via email or whatever it is. You can find it with Mark, and I'll get you the number.
You can put it on the blog later on. Let's go to the next question.
No problem.
Yep.
Second, why are we being asked all the time, what do we have to give in order to have peace? Why don't you ask the Palestinians, why don't you put your guns down and start behaving like, you know, civilians? And
well, I tell you, I did ask Ms. Najab in the first half hour.
And obviously they don't do that.
Well, she said that that's because they're not being given any piece of territory. She
this
said
is
that
not true.
She doesn't
this
support
is,
attacks
this
on
is
children.
Totally untrue. Just for the reason, I mean, you talked about Arafat back in 1964. He started his terror attacks.
Yes,
back
he did.
In 1964, when the area was occupied by the Jordanians.
True.
And he attacked Israel. Why?
Well, but see, you're right, Mr. Zinnar. You're absolutely right about that. But here we are 40 years after 1964, and without defending Yasser Arafat, who I think I can agree with you is as bad a terrorist as you think he was, what do we do today? What can Israel do today about Palestinians who are 10 and 20 years old, who are born long after 1964? What can Israel do today to reassure them that they have a future where they can have a state of their own?
I, again, I'm not a politician, and I can tell you what we must not do. We must not uproot model citizens, peaceful citizens, hardworking citizens, throw them away from their homes and their children, and tell them, you know, that's a sacrifice. The people who must sacrifice is those, the terrorists. And they don't have to do much.
Let me ask you this.
Just stop being a terrorist.
Just stop being a terrorist, and then what? If the Palestinians stop the attacks,
what
would you be willing to give up?
You know, okay, Mark, there are certain areas in the country that after the Oslo Agreement that were fairly safe, they flourished.
The attacks stopped after Oslo.
One second.
Yeah.
Israelis would go there, do business with them. They have generated over $500 million a year, some stores. And after the 2000 riots, it stopped because nobody felt safe anymore. So, had they been peaceful, had they been like, you know, civilians, true civilians who look for peace, who want to make a living, you know, living together would come natural. More so, our government had given them authority over all of their civilian systems. So, and they got, of course, they got weaponry and they got a police. They had almost everything. All they had to do, just use it.
We're coming up on the end of the hour. Let me. I would like to just make a quick comment and read an entry and give you one more chance to respond. My quick view is that you're absolutely right. After Oslo, Israel gave the Palestinians every chance, and Yasser Arafat blew it. And he blew it by bringing up violence to when he should have negotiated Camp David. I completely agree with you. But now that Arafat's gone, shouldn't there be given a second chance? And before you answer that, I want to read a comment on my blog from a woman named Didi. And here's what she writes. She writes, Mark, Mr. Zinnar just goes to show that Israel does not want peace, and they're just land grabbers who have stolen Palestinian lands. She writes, the fanatic settlers are just as bad as the fanatic suicide bombers. Compromise needs to happen on both sides. If Israel is not willing to do this, the problems will continue. Mr. Bush should make this his first priority in his second term, as Mr. Blair has urged him all along. She writes, Mr. Zinnar, I would love to visit Israel someday, but you need to make concessions for peace, period. How do you respond to me and to Didi?
What I would tell her that, you know, we don't have that much time.
No, we don't.
But you know, if we want to rewrite history and change history, that's fine, but it's not the truth. And the truth says that this is our homeland. It's ours. Now, before we
Isn't
talk
it
about
both peoples?
Compromises, you know, President Bush sent American soldiers all the way across the ocean to fight terror, while in the meantime, he invites the worst terrorist ever to come to the White House. I think it's awkward. And that's what I want to tell Didi. Listen, this is terror. It could come to your doorstep. You will not let anybody who's going to come to your living room and behave as if it's his own house.
Mr. Zinnar, I'm afraid our time is up. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to call in all the way from the Gaza Strip. I don't agree with you, but I understand your views, and I appreciate your helping our listeners understand your views. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Thank you.
Talk again.
You know, Didi, I would respond to you like this. I have troubles with both the views of both my guests. I think that both sides need to do more compromise. I actually think that Sharon's plan, though, to leave Gaza first is a good idea. Yasser Arafat is gone. Mr. Zinnar is right. Yasser Arafat is a terrorist, and indeed, his ways of success should never have have been allowed to succeed. After the Oslo Peace Accords, there was a lull in the violence. Arafat had every opportunity in 2000 to take 95%+. He rejected that opportunity. He was dead wrong. Mr. Zinar's right about that. However, Yasser Arafat is gone now, and I agree with you that the settlers need to understand there have to be some compromises made for peace. I would just want to assure you, though, that Mr. Zinar, and I'm very thankful he would come on the show, I appreciate that, but he does not represent the majority Israeli view. He represents a view that is to the right of the Prime Minister Sharon. The Israeli Knesset just voted to go ahead and do Mr. Sharon's plan to leave Gaza and to save the negotiation of the West Bank for a later day. I would hope that people like Nadia Hijab would see that as a first step, and that people like Ehud Zinar would see that as a necessary way to show that Israel, to show the Palestinians that they can give up something for peace, and hopefully minds that are more compromising than either Ms. Hijab or Mr. Zinar will recognize this first step for what it is, and the violence will stop. And I believe if the violence stops, that you will see the great majority of Israelis, maybe not Mr. Zinar, but maybe him as well, if the violence stops, I think you'll see a great majority